Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore on Colfax. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. It is a great pleasure for me to introduce New York Times bestselling award-winning author John Lacroix, who will talk about his newest work, The Keeper, a riveting novel featuring Dismas Hardy and Abe Glitzky on the hunt for clues about a woman who's gone missing and her husband is the prime suspect. John, as you know, is best known for his legal crime thrillers, and I think you've written 24 books?
Somewhere like that.
It's about 26. Maybe 26, so we're really pleased to have him here, so please welcome John Lacroix.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. Denver's a great town. I flew in yesterday in the middle of the storm. It was terrific. So I thought I would start here tonight before I talk about The Keeper. I thought I'd start by talking about the last few months in my life because they've been unusual and interesting, and I think they are relevant to what I'm going to wind up talking about. About maybe a year ago, this trend started where I got asked to be contributing to various short story anthologies. And the first one that I got asked to contribute to was a book that came out by the Mystery Writers of America called Ice Cold, which is stories about the Cold War. And I didn't have any idea what I was going to write about, but I said, you know, I'm glad you asked me to be a member of this, you know, august group of writers, and I'm going to go and, you know, think about it. So I put in back of my mind, next thing I know, I'm in New York City last July, and Steve Berry of the International Thriller Writers comes up to me, and he says, John, would like you to, if you don't mind, would like to have you be included in an anthology we're putting together where we're going to be, it's going to be called Face Off, and we're going to take a main character from one person and a main character from another author and put them together in one story and have them play together, you know. So I said, well, that sounds like a terrific idea. I'm going to think about that. Yes, I'm in. So third thing that happens is a guy named Les Klinger, who is the author of the annotated Sherlock Holmes stories. He's got, you know, like a 1,500-page reference manual. Les is writing a book called In the Footsteps of Sherlock. And he came up to me when I was down in Southern California, and he said, John, I know you've written some Holmes books. Would you be interested in writing another Holmes story as part of this, you know, project? And I said, you know, I really can't. I said, I got to book I've got to write for this year. I got a book I got to write for next year. I've already said I'm going to be in two or three other anthologies. So I'm not going to be able to do that. So a couple of months went by. Next thing you know, I get a call from Jeff Deaver, who is the editor of the first book I mentioned, Ice Cold. And he said, so I bet that's moving along pretty good right about now, huh? And I said, haven't really got it to there yet. Haven't really got an idea. So I didn't have an idea for that. And then the next thing that happened is Barry calls me up and he goes, so you and T. Jefferson Parker are going to be in this face-off together. And how's that working out? How you got that moving? And I said, not so much. Don't really have anything going on that one. And then Les Klinger calls me up and he goes, you know, we really need you to fill this out. And we need, you know, you to think about Sherlock Holmes. And I said, well, I don't really think I can because I'm busy and all that stuff. So about January 15th, for some reason, I was sitting at my office, and every day I go into work, I have a regular day job, which is writing, luckily. And I sat down and all of a sudden found myself writing this story for Ice Cold, set in the Cold War in about the mid-60s. And it turned out to be this incredible story. I still think it's the best thing I've ever written. It's called The Last Confession, and I just loved it. And there was no thought in making this short story come about. It just all of a sudden I was writing the short story. Well, a few weeks later, maybe even less than that, Jeff Parker calls me up and he goes, well, what do you think we're going to do about this story? Don't you think we should get an idea going or something? And I said, well, I'm not really sure, but why don't I just think about it? Well, I sat down and I wrote the first seven pages of this story. without any thought at all. I sent it off to him. He said, what are you going to do? What, you know, how are you going to come back? Blah, blah, blah. We talked. 2 days later, we're done. And it's great. Everybody loves it. It's like perfect. So I say, well, I really got to get back to my, you know, regular job of writing the book that's going to come out in 2015. So I go into work on a Tuesday morning, not expecting anything. And suddenly I'm just completely overwhelmed by this Sherlock Holmes idea, which I'd even told Les I wasn't going to do twice. Well, 3 days later, I had a 50-page short story done. And it was terrific. I loved it. I sent it in to Les. I went, this is great. So how does all this relate to my novel writing? Well, at the same time, I was trying to write this book. Okay? This book didn't have any idea behind it. I knew I had to hand in a book last July, and I had to, you know, give them an outline first. And so I wrote to my publishers and I sent them a 4 or 5 page outline where I cleverly avoided any plot points. I didn't really talk about what was the book going to be about. Didn't really have any kind of a big theme. I just said, you know, I had just read Gone Girl and I thought Gone Girl was fantastic. And I thought you could do a lot of different things with the whole idea of a missing woman. And I thought this is a good thing to explore. It seems like a good commercial idea. So I just decided I'm going to start putting down pages. So I was about the time all these short stories were happening, I was about 100 pages into this book, and I still didn't know what it was about. So I called up my good buddy Al Giannini, who's my consultant on all things legal and a lot of things plot-wise, and I sent the book to him, you know, the first 100 pages, and I said, so read them and tell me what you think and, you know, see if you get any idea of what the book might be about. So he read the 100 pages and he goes, you know, I don't have any idea what it's about. He says, but the good thing is I'm really liking it. It's a cool story. And I said, well, yeah, because all I do is I go in every day and I just try to write scenes that I find interesting and fun. And that, I realized, is what I'd been doing with this book and with all these short stories. Because the one thing you have to do if you're a professional writer is you have to keep putting out product. And if you stop doing that, then you stop doing your job. So I had this book moving ahead. I get to page, you know, 180. I get to page 200. I get to page 300. Around page 300 of a book that turned out to be 320 pages long, I said, I think I see what this book is doing. So I went back and I added in a few plot points here and there. And all through the book, though, I was going, you know, I don't really know what it's about, but it's really kind of great. It's really got a good feel. It reads well. You know, they're all the scenes are really fun. And so I thought what I would do today as a kind of a example of how this really happens is I'd like to read you a few short scenes. And there's no chance I'm going to give away any plot. I mean, I'll promise you there is plot in this book. But when I wrote it, I had no idea what it was. And so I decided just stick to the scenes and have a little fun. And so I will read 3 very short passages, and you'll get an idea of what I'm talking about. This is the first fun scene, occurs on page 7. Actually, there's lots of fun scenes before that, but this is the one I'm reading. The dartboard in Dismas Hardy's office was designed to look like an upscale cherry wood cabinet. Behind its dark, polished wooden doors was a professional-quality board on a green beige backdrop. Hardy never, ever missed the board entirely. Not exactly camouflaged, but subtle, was a cherry wood throwing line built into his light hardwood floor. Now he stood at that line and threw a dart that landed in the center of the four, his target. He was playing his 3rd round of 20 down today, and so far this round he hadn't missed. His coat hung over the chair behind his desk, his collar and tie were loose, and he knew that he was in the zone, locked. He had one more dart this round. Taking very little time so that he wouldn't think and screw it all up, he hefted his little tungsten beauty with its custom-made blue flights and let fly. Nailed it, the 3. 1 round away from perfection. He'd come this close once before when the telephone rang and distracted him as he was setting up to throw. So now he hesitated a moment before going to the board to retrieve his last round. He knew he could walk over to the desk and take the phone off the hook, but by his own internal rules, that would be cheating. He could call Phyllis out in the lobby and tell her to hold his calls for exactly 1 minute, although she would, ask him why, and ruin his concentration. Or he could ignore the phone altogether, keep his head out of it, get his darts right now, and throw the goddamn things. Finally, giving these options no more than the split second that they were worth, he moved forward, retrieved his round from the board, walked back to the baseline, turned in a measured and unhurried fashion, lifted his first dart, aimed, and threw. Two. Second to last dart. One. No thought. Don't think. Don't think. Throw it, throw it, throw it. Bullseye. Ha! Yes! Hardy threw up his hands in a touchdown gesture. Thank you, thank you, thank you, he said aloud, pumping his fist. Yes! After three quick knocks, his office door opened and Phyllis was standing there with a look of alarm. Is everything all right? I heard you calling out. I'm great. I'm at a peak moment. Hardy, beaming, his arms again halfway raised, motioned her inside. Check this out. He gestured to the dartboard. I ask you, is that a thing of beauty? A last round, 2-1 bullseye, 20 down and no misses? First time ever? Is that awesome or what? His receptionist secretary shot a nervous glance over at the board, then back at her boss. Very nice, she said, with some uncertainty, but I really think I should get back to the phones. She had barely started back toward her workstation when a man in a uniform appeared behind her, tapping on the open door. Excuse me, he said. I don't know if I'm in the right office. I'm trying to find a lawyer named Dismas Hardy. So that is, we get to know Hardy a little bit. And the gentleman who is coming into their office right now is a guy named Hal Chase. Hal's wife has gone missing on the day after Thanksgiving, or day before Thanksgiving. It is now the Monday following that day. And since his wife is going to be a big part of this book, I knew that even when I knew I didn't have a plot, I knew that I needed to have some kind of knowledge about Hal and his wife, Katie, and what they were like. I didn't really know them yet, but I decided to write a very, very short little scene to show a little bit about their relationship. When Katie was pregnant with their first child, Ellen, she and Hal had nicknamed her Zy for zygote. Every night before they went to sleep, he kissed Katie's stomach, and if that didn't lead to something else, he would say, keeping his mouth close, "Hi, Zy, your daddy loves you." Now newborn Ellen lay swaddled on Katie's stomach outside the delivery room. 25 hours of labor with Hal by her side every minute of it, and then, at last, the delivery of the healthy child. Hal looked down on her tiny face, her eyes scrunched closed. He touched her cheek. Leaning over, he gently kissed his exhausted wife. Then he looked down at the baby. "Hi, Zy," he said. 30 minutes old, the baby opened her eyes. Only for a second or two, but it was there, a definite moment of recognition, and she smiled at him. Hal broke down and sobbed. I love that scene. And then, just a little bit later, it turns out Franny Hardy, Dismas's wife, is in the business of marriage and family counseling. And the reason that Hal had known to contact Dismas Hardy is because his wife was one of Franny's clients. So now Franny knows that he's hooked up with Hal Chase somehow, and they're at home at night. Franny Hardy was sipping her coffee at the dinner table. Putting the cup down, she shook her head and leveled an admiring gaze at her husband. Sometimes, she said, you simply astound me. Thank you. You mean because I'm already on board with Hal Chase? Not really that, no. Well, what then? Well, the fact that you've been home for about 2 hours and we've just had a leisurely and pleasant dinner together, and you have spent nearly every minute of that time talking to me about your perfect game of darts this morning. I know, it was groundbreaking. Evidently so, making every single shot from 20 down to and including the bullseye without one miss. Not even the bullseye? Bullseye is the killer. Yes, of course it is, and you described it all so perfectly. I feel like I was there witnessing it all firsthand, the thrill of victory. Especially the last round, Hardy said. Could you believe how I cleared my mind instead of thinking about it and letting the tension get to me? That's what could have done me in, but no. I just picked those suckers out of the board, walked back to the line, turned through, bam, bam, bam. I think you did mention the mind meld thing the first time. Or the second. One of them, anyway. And that's not what astounded you? No, actually, it was nothing about the darts game. Do you want me to guess? I really don't think you could, Diz, so I'll tell you. What astounded me is that my client's husband came to your office this morning and asked you to be his lawyer because he was afraid they were going to charge him with murder. And then you met Abe Glitzky for lunch and got him on board as your investigator. And all of this was really further down your list of interesting things that happened today than your perfect score in 20 down? Hardy shrugged. I've had lots of clients, Fran, but never a perfect game. Think about it. What would you rank higher, interest-wise? She stared at him. Amazing. He nodded. Thank you. So anyway, so that's how you write a book. You just put a bunch of crazy scenes together, and then things start to work out, and eventually it all falls together, and you have a book. So that's how it kind of works. I just thought I'd share that with you and, you know, see how this goes. This is book number 26, I do believe. And I think it's about number 15 in the Dismas Hardy Abe Glitzky series. Came out on Tuesday. I have no idea whether it's on New York Times list yet because it's not been out long enough. But I'm here if you'd like to have any discussions about anything to do with the book world or about being an author. And otherwise, I'll be happy to sign all your books. Yeah. Oh, the second one. Oh, this is a great one. Yeah, it's called Face Off. And Face Off will come out on June the 6th. And it's being published by Simon & Schuster. It's put together by the International Thriller Writers. And what that organization does is it doesn't charge dues to its members. It pays for itself by coming out with a book every year that's contributed to by the members of the organization. So we've had Thriller is the first one. First Thrills is another one. 100 Best Thrillers of All Time is another one. This one is, you know, Face Off. Face Off is a cool idea, I have to admit. And I had a blast writing this story with Jeff. And we have 10 other pairs of authors who have contributed stories. The interesting thing about this, and this is a little bit of a... it's a secret, so, you know, but I'm going to tell you, because it's going to be announced in a couple of days anyway. And the coolest thing about this is we went to sell this book to the publishing world, and they offered us $500,000 for it. And it is currently scheduled, it looks like, we've already got pre-orders, that it's going to be the first anthology ever to make the New York Times bestseller list in hardcover. Isn't this amazing? It's just the coolest idea ever, and it really worked well. I mean, everybody who did it enjoyed doing it, and it was just so much fun, I can't tell you. Well, like, for example, Jeffrey Deaver is writing with John Sanford, and his story is called Rhymes with Prey. For now, for people who don't know, Jeffrey Deaver has a guy named Rhymes, and all of the Sanford books have Prey in the title. So Rhymes with Prey is perfect. And I think Michael Conley is on. No, Lee Child with Joe Finder. I mean, it's a class group of gang. I'm really pretty happy. Pardon? It's Reacher and what's Finder's guy? Joe Finder's stuff? I don't know his guy's name. But yeah, Reacher's in it. I mean, everybody's in it. It's just... I picked my guy Wyatt Hunt. And Jeff Parker's guy is Joe Trona from Silent Joe. And so the two of them meet up on a fishing trip in Baja, California, that Jeff and I really went on that fishing trip together. So we had that connection anyway, and we just said, let's move them down to Baja, you know, have some fun, and, you know, it's great. So anyway, that one is, and they may have that one here tonight. I mean, it may be in the store. It's called Ice Cold. No, that one's called Face Off. That's not in the store. Ice Cold might be out right now. So you can check that. It's cool. Yeah.
So how many years does that $500,000 run the Thriller Writers?
It should run at least 5. The great news is when you get that kind of a, you know, publishing deal that kind of starts a buzz going, it then gets picked up. It's now been picked up in 17 countries. And all of them have separate deals. So it may wind up bringing in $1 million before it's even sold a book, which is pretty great. So it's really fun.
When you first started writing the Dismas books, yeah.
You know what? I had no clue at all. In fact, I wrote the first Dismas book only because I had already written 2 Sherlock Holmes pastiches. So I finished those books, Son of Holmes and Rasputin's Revenge. And then I got a letter from the Holmes estate. and my publisher at the time, a guy named Donald I. Fine, did not pay the $50 licensing fee to ask if I could do it. $50, I'm not kidding, $50. And so they they wrote me and said they would sue me if I wrote another Holmes book. So, and the only reason I was able to write this new one is because Les Klinger just got an appeal from the Supreme Court saying that Holmes is now in the public domain. That just happened about, 6 months ago. So Les immediately jumped up and said, hey, let's get another anthology of Holmes stuff together. So, and the cool thing about my story in that, this is the story that I had no idea I was going to write. In fact, I wasn't going to write. It turns out that story, I believe, is going to be published in the Strand magazine as a standalone piece to be a promotional tool for selling that whole book. So it's really exciting, actually. Yeah.
Why did you decide to retire Abe Blitzky? And if he's an investigator and the keeper, what happened to Hunt?
He's on his honeymoon. That's where Hunt is. I don't want to get into spoilers right now. But let me just tell you that it's all clearly explained.
Okay.
I don't think you'll have a problem with it. I wanted to go back, though, just a minute to the whole Dismas Hardy, how did he get here? So I wrote a Dismas Hardy story, but at the time I wrote it, not kind of like this book, all I thought it was going to be was a redemption story about a guy who was a bartender and, he wasn't a lawyer. I didn't know anything about him. But I thought he was an interesting character, and I'd like to write about him. So I wrote Dead Irish. I didn't know it was a mystery. When I sent it into this guy, Donald I. Fine, he said, if you just change a couple of chapters around, structurally, this can be a mystery. And then you'll be a mystery writer, and we'll be able to pay you more money. And I go, because, literary books don't necessarily sell for as much money. And I said, money's an issue. I could do more money. So I said, it's the same words, and so I changed it around. I wrote that book, then I wrote The Vig, which is the second one. Then I had an interesting time in my life where I got spinal meningitis and was in a coma for 11 days. When I got out of that, I decided, I'm going to leave L.A., which is where we lived, and I'm going to move up to Davis, where I live now, which is Northern California. And I'm going to write a different kind of book. I'm going to write a big, tome, really much more of a large palette to work with, bigger themes, and an actual physically bigger book. So I wrote the first of these legal thrillers, okay? The only problem was nobody bought it. So I'm sitting there kind of struggling, not getting very much money. And I finally said, I'm going to give it one more try. So I knew I liked this character. I knew that he could be a lawyer because I had luckily made him inadvertently a lawyer from the very first page of the first book. So I brought him back to the law, and I wrote a book called The 13th Juror, which became a very big international bestseller and changed my whole life. Okay? But here's what happened. Because of the delay in publishing, nothing happens until a year later, I didn't think anybody liked Dismas Hardy because nobody was buying them. I wasn't selling any copies of the books. So I said, before I knew this book was going to become a bestseller, I said, I got to write another book. So I said, I really like this guy, Abe Blitzky. I'm going to write him. So I wrote a whole book following, 13th Juror with Abe Blitzky as the lead character and Hardy not even in the book. And then I did another one after that. That's how long it took because it was a my book became a hit in paperback. So I had this 2-year hiatus during which, as far as I was concerned, I was never going to write another Hardy book. And then suddenly, 13th Juror comes out. It's just a monster. It's a bestseller for something like 3.5 months. And I mean, it sells in every country in the world. And all of a sudden, I'm happening. And the first thing that happens when I'm happening is my publisher comes back to me and goes, you got to write another Dismas Hardy book. So this is the clever way that I planned my career so that I could write 3 Dismas Hardy books, then leave that series entirely with Abe Blitzky, then come back and somehow try to fit Abe Blitzky into the Dismas Hardy series. And, it's all worked out. But it was not a plan. It was not a real good plan. Pardon me?
Are you going to write any more Abe Blitzky?
Well, I think this book would pretty close to qualify as a Blitzky book.
Oh.
He becomes the main focus, in spite of all of the dart stuff, and everything else. But there's a couple of early scenes when Dismas and Abe are trying to get together and how they're going to work together. And Hardy kind of does this, and you'll see it's kind of fun. It's maybe funnier than the darts scenes. They're negotiating with one another. So they're a lot of fun to work with. So anybody else want to talk about anything? Yeah.
How did you come up with the idea for that restaurant across the street from the courthouse and all those screens?
It's not a real place. No. There used to be a restaurant there named Zuka's, and it was kind of the divey place. But one of the rules I have about writing restaurants is if it's going to be a great restaurant, I'm going to use the real name. And if it's going to be a place where you get ptomaine poisoning or something like that, you kind of want to make up a different thing. But one of the great things that Lou the Greeks has done for me in all of my books is, and this goes right back to what I was talking about earlier, about, you know, you don't really know why these scenes have to be in the book, but you have to keep writing and making interesting things happen. Every single book, I get to one or two places where I just go, I have no idea what I'm doing, but I can always write a Lou the Greek scene. And so you throw in Lou the Greek, and all of a sudden I'm rolling along, and then I got five more pages, and I'm happy, and I get up the next day and keep going. So that's the way these books tend to get written, and it's goofy, but it's true. So
I heard once that you had been authored a couple of movies for some of the Disney books.
Mm-hmm.
Is that still a possibility?
Well, let's say, yes, it's still a possibility, but it's not what I'd call a real close possibility. Lawrence Fishburne 2 years ago optioned the whole series. And we were very enthusiastic and upbeat. We wound up getting a showrunner, an executive director. We got two stars to be in it. Everybody agreed. The studios all love the idea. I wrote what's called a Bible, where you actually tell the story of all of the people. And so we were all good to go up until the night before it was due. In fact, the night before they were going to decide, they said they were going to take it. That was on a Thursday night, and Friday at lunchtime, they went in for the. No, it was all of them. They were going to do the whole thing. It was going to be a TV show that was going to be happening. Yeah, the Hardy Chronicles. Yeah, well, it's still possible. You know, it's still out there. I'm shopping it, but it's just.
Is there one of them? I'm sorry.
No, that's all right.
Is there one of them that you would like to see? Which
as an individual story, I would love to see The First Law shot as an individual story. Because it's, you know, that could be a movie because it's pretty much a modern version of the OK Corral, which is, after all, the most filmed event in American history, I mean, in movies-wise. And so I very, very consciously tried to make it, you know, three-act structure. It's definitely got all this stuff. It has this kind of violent ending. It's got everything you want in a movie. And, you know, it hadn't been taken yet. And if any of you guys know any producers and want to call them up, that'd be great. I'm open for it, so we'll see. We can sign some books. Okay, thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.